Howie.
Proverbs 12:16. Let's start there and then on into Leviticus. It's going to be the best teaching on Leviticus you've ever heard because it's the only teaching on Leviticus you've ever heard. Proverbs 12:16. Any of you guys hunters or been hunting before? I'm from Texas, so a few of you may be familiar with that. If you're hunting a deer, what are different ways you can lure a deer in? Spray, okay, so the spray is like a female sex hormone, right? So it attracts them based on, is it called estrus? I think that's what it's called. Anyways, it lures them based on that sense, okay? So you can appeal to their sexual drive. What else? Call, yeah, if it's in the rut, okay, same thing there. So you're, so you know your stuff. What other noises? Or what other things that you can use? Food, right? So how I kill my first and only deer. Big thing of deer feed at a 30-30, and I ate that deer for a long time. It was really good. I ate deer jerky for a long time. You can also take antlers and bang them together, right? And it creates a noise that is, what does that do for a deer? What does that tell them is going on? Yeah, there's bucks fighting. They're competing for their territory, competing for these other women, right? So they'll come in and come to figure out what that noise is so they can defend their territory, right? There are certain base level things that draw a deer in, just like there are for us. See also Proverbs 12:16. A fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. The idea being that base level issue in said individual, this fool, is his anger. That anger issue is not able to, in a fool, be concealed. It gets revealed immediately, just like in a deer. He smells food, smells estrus, hears the banging of antlers, whatever it is, can't withhold that, and immediately comes to said situation that gets shot by me and eaten. So it's a good day for me. A wise man, a prudent man, according to verse 16, does the opposite. They're able to be offended. They're able to be dishonored and yet conceal their anger, right? They're like a gun on safety, right? All the necessary parts are there to fire and to go off and cause an explosion, but they have a safety. They have the ability to count 10, as Huck Finn says, right, and to not blow their lid and not respond in anger, okay? That is the difference between a fool here and one who is a prudent man. Yes, Stephen. Yeah, there's certainly a point in your head where you can, it cannot come out of your mouth, but it's still sin. However, you can also be angry and yet not sin. That was said of Jesus, right? There is such thing as a righteous anger. There is such thing as the ability to be offended and to say, you know what? I'm not going to respond to that, right? And to collect yourself. So I think depending on how you handle it. Now, if you're having the same conversation in your head that you're just not having out loud with said individual, you know what? I'll show you. That's a different path, right? It's just not coming out your mouth. But there is a way when someone has wronged you and you choose not to respond in kind and are able to put down your lower level passions by walking in the spirit and say, okay, I'm not going to do that. That is a quality that marks a wise individual, right? Young men, by the way, ladies, it's not so much typical of you, but young dudes with testosterone tend to brag about that ability to go off on everything and to be angry and to tell, you know, whatever, to defend our whatever. That is a non-godly quality that we'll tend to elevate as if that's some good thing, that we have a short fuse and blow up on people or what have you to defend our maleness or whatever it is, okay? I don't know if ladies tend to struggle with that as maybe guys do, but that's base in us as just kind of how we're wired in our DNA, okay? By the way, this is one of the number one qualities that said of Abraham Lincoln, who was just unflappable. People would attempt to ruffle his feathers, to speak to him in ways that would cause him to respond in kind, and he just wouldn't do it. Okay, he was this gigantic guy, and he always spoke in a very small voice, so people would come close to him, and he could exercise a bit of, they would make them kind of come underneath him if he would. He was a smart guy, but he would never lose his temper. He would never respond the way that other people were responding in the midst of issues that he had to deal with that were hard and difficult, obviously, as President of the United States. So think about that with you, okay? What is your tendency? when you are wronged, when you are dishonored, do you respond in kind, or do you have the ability to put yourself on safety and to not fire and to not go off and to conceal dishonor and handle it in a righteous way, right? Not like Stephen said, having the, you know, cussing somebody out in your head. That's not any better than cussing them out loud, I suppose. But that's the idea, all right? So make sure that we are individuals that are working on concealing dishonor by walking in the Spirit, and that's ultimately the key to how we're able to manage said feelings and what have you by walking with God, all right? Thoughts on that? And go shoot a deer. Speaking of Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law, last year we went to Missouri and had, they're from Tennessee, we're obviously from California, had Thanksgiving in Missouri because it was kind of halfway. He killed a deer and we ate deer steak the entire week. It was amazing. So if you've never had it, very good. Different, but very good. All right, so we're in Leviticus, okay? We know nothing about it because I haven't told you anything. Okay, what have you guys seen so far? Think through Leviticus with me. We've seen some ideas of these offerings, right? Chapter 1, we saw what? Burnt offerings. And what was the, what was offered? Okay, unblemished goat, male, sheep, okay? But they're all male. And what was the... what was the purpose of the burnt offering according to verse 4? Yeah, you're making atonement for what? Sin, obviously, right? So these are, there's a one-for-one deal, okay? As we talk about, by the way, the different views of down the road as we get into the New Testament, you guys are already there in the Gospels and have been there, but as we talk about that, what Christ did on our behalf, there are many different views of the crucifixion and his death on our behalf. Penal substitution is taught all the way from the garden, all the way forward, okay? And if you miss that concept that Christ died in your place, in my place, and paid the penalty for a sin, for sins that we should have paid, you're missing the nature of the gospel, right? He wasn't just a good example. It wasn't just a ransom theory where he took our place. This idea of one having to lay his life down on behalf of another because of what the other could not do, and there had to be blood to atone for that sin, that is the picture that God is showing to the Hebrews all through the wilderness journey, and he's been showing them all the way since the garden, okay? So make sure as you guys are reading Scripture, you're seeing that with those lenses, and if you hear people that are teaching a view of the crucifixion or Christ's death, his death on the cross, it is not penal substitution, that should cause you to panic. Correct. Okay. Haley, hold that for a second. Let's see if we deal with it this morning. I think you're going to see the picture, and we'll get there. Okay. So that's the idea. So burnt offerings. Okay. What do we see in chapter 2? A grain offering. What was the difference with this one? Yeah, it's for peace. Was it to atone for sin? No, right? It's a Thanksgiving offering of some sort based on the condition of the offerer's heart, right? It's a Thanksgiving to God. Okay. Chapter 3, we got into another one. Did we get that yet?
Yeah.
We did? Okay. What offering was that? The peace offering. Okay. Same process, right? You saw some of the same deals. It's for sin. It's unblemished. But what was different about this one?
Female.
Or female this time, right? So male or female. So there's a variation on what they're for. Okay. So we walked through that in chapter 4. In chapter 3. Now in chapter 4, we're going to see another one. Okay. And this is probably one of the more... common's the wrong word, but this would have been a frequent offering in Israel. Okay, 4 verse 2. Let's pick up there.
Now speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally against any of the commandments of the Lord, and anything which ought not to be done, and does any of them, if the anointed priest sins, bringing guilt on the people, and let him offer to the Lord for his sins, since which the people have sinned, a young bull without blemish.
All right, so stop there for a second. So what do you notice about this one? Okay, this is called the sin offering. What's different in the way it's described? What would require you to give this one?
Unintentional.
It's unintentional. What does that mean? What is an unintentional sin? Yeah, give me an example of something today that's like, oh gosh, I had no idea I sinned.
Yeah,
that could be one. yeah, maybe I said something and I really offended somebody and didn't know that I did, but boy, it was my words that caused that offense and they were not misinterpreted or whatever, but I caused that. I didn't mean to sin, but I did. I just offended you. Well, now I need to go to you and say, wow, I'm sorry. I blew that. That's my fault. I apologize. Will you forgive me? I should not have said that. That's an unintentional sin, okay? So things like that. And there's a list that they give. Now, notice the people that are included in this system. Verse 3, you see the first one, the priest. So you're telling me the priests sin? They're not above the law? They're not perfect? No, right? They have to offer sacrifice for themselves as well. So what do you notice with that's inherently broken in this system? What type of high priest do we have? His name's Jesus. Does he offer sin for himself, sin sacrifices? No. Why? Because he's perfect, because he does not sin. In this system, we have a priest that sins. So they have a special role, but they are no different than everyday Joe, everyday Jane. Okay, so they have to offer sacrifices for themselves as well. Okay, so the priest, verse 3. You see kind of the requirement there in verse 4 and following, the bull, the doorway of the tent of meeting, they have to have another priest offer their sacrifice on their behalf, okay, if they sin. Look at verse 13. Now, if the whole congregation of Israel commits error, so if anybody and everybody in the congregation blows it, this can be a sacrifice for not just one person, but for many, okay? Look at verse 22. When a leader sins, a head of a household, someone who's been given authority, like one of the people that Moses chose that exercised authority over the tens or the hundreds or the thousands. If one of those guys sins, is it applicable for them as well? Absolutely, because they're going to sin. Verse 27, now if anyone of the common people sins unintentionally, doing any of the things which the Lord has commanded, what's the idea of the sin or this sacrifice? Who is it for? Everybody. So what's assumed in this process? Everybody's going to sin, and you're going to have your sin atoned for at some place along the way. It may be intentional, like a burnt offering would cover, where you absolutely spoke in anger and words came out of your mouth that were wrong or what have you, and you knew you did it, and boy, you've got to get that atoned for. Or it may just be, man, Lord, I've lived 365 days this year, and I've probably done something stupid at some point that I'm not aware of. I probably should just offer a sin offering just to make sure we're good, right? That's the idea. So when your heart is convicted and you know, you offer sacrifices, and when your heart is convicted for things, you're like, man, I may have. I don't know, but I probably should anyway. That's the idea, okay? So this whole chapter, and chapter 5 as well, walks through the requirements of that sin offering, who it would be for, what they have to do. And again, it's unintentional. Here's one of the ways in their context that you can become unintentionally, you can unintentionally sin. Look at 5 verse 2.
Or if a person touches an unclean thing, whether it is a carcass or an unclean beast, or the carcass of unclean livestock, or the carcass of unclean creeping things, and is unaware of it, he also shall be unclean and guilty.
All right, so we're going to read this as we get on into Leviticus about clean and unclean. God is going to deem certain animals clean, certain animals unclean. He's going to say dead carcasses of said animals are unclean. If a person is going through certain situations, they are deemed unclean. And if you accidentally touch them, now you're unclean as well. So you could bump into so-and-so who's unclean that doesn't know they're unclean yet, and all of a sudden you're unclean, but you didn't sin intentionally, but you still have to offer a sin offering because you became accidentally unclean. You with me? So we'll talk through the nature of sin versus clean and unclean because those are different. But this would have been a sacrifice for those types of things.
Are these only bulls that can be sacrificed and just skinned it and that's what it
was? I think so. Yeah, four at the top of it talks about it. These are the bull that's mentioned in 4. Yeah, that's the other thing that you guys need to think through. This is a pretty expensive process, right? Why would God make, if there's a lot of obvious reasons, why would God make this such a sacrifice to offer sacrifice? Right? Would you think through your life a little bit differently? Would you think through the promises that you make or the words that come out of your mouth or how bad you want to respond in anger right now, but go, well, that's going to cost me a bull. And that's food for my family for how long, right? I'm going to give that to God. Like, there's a reason. God's showing us the cost of their words and their actions and their interaction with human beings. And God's like, it's purposeful why he does what he does, okay? So, burnt offering, grain offering, peace offering, sin offering. Okay, so we've seen four. Now turn to 5 verse 14, and we will see now a fifth offering.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if a person commits a trespass and sins unintentionally in regards to the holy things of the Lord, then he shall bring to the Lord all his trespass offering, offering a ram without blemish from the flocks with your valuation in shekels of silver according to the shekels of the sanctuary as the trespass offering.
All right, so what do you notice it's similar to the previous offering with the guilt offering? Okay, it's a bull. What type of sin is it?
Unintentional.
Okay, so now this one is unique. Verse 16, he shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing and shall add to it a fifth part of it and give it to the priest. The priest shall then take make atonement for him with the ram for the guilt offering and shall be forgiven to him. Okay, look at verse 4 of chapter 6. He shall become guilty. He shall restore what he took by robbery or what he got by extortion or deposit, which he was entrusted to him, the lost thing which was found, verse 5, or anything about which he swore falsely, he shall make restitution for it in full and add to it one-fifth more, 20%. He shall give it to the one whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering. So you, Jacob and I are in a business transaction, and I steal from him, right? Knowingly, I take from him, okay? Not only do I have to go to the priest and make a guilt offering on my behalf to cleanse my sins, what do I have to do between Jacob and myself to be right?
Pay him back with interest.
I've got to pay him back with 20% interest, okay? So if I took money or stuff, I've got to return said money and stuff plus 20% to make it right, okay? That, by the way, is the story of Zacchaeus in chapter 19 of Luke. That's why he gave back. He was a tax collector, and he returns the money that he took from the people plus a fifth, okay, based on him trying to follow the Levitical law, okay? So fascinating. So God makes sure that interpersonal relationships are taken care of. So when you sin against another, that you make that right, okay? And you add to it based on the person's you've offended them, you've put them in a difficult spot, you've inconvenienced them, whatever, you make sure you pay them back in full, okay? So, five offerings we've seen so far, and you get a different picture of what they're for, why they're there, different aspects of why you offer what you offer and the things that you can offer, okay? And then as you notice in verse 8 and following, anybody have like a chapter heading over chapter 6, verse 8? Okay, and then what's the first offering you see mentioned in there? Burnt offering, verse 14. Grain offering, verse 24. Sin offering, we've seen all these before. 7, verse 1, guilt offering. 7, verse 11, peace offering, all the way through the end of chapter 7. Okay, so these are added details on the offerings that we just read about. Okay, so they go into more elaborate situations. Well, if this happens, then this, and these are the situations. Here's what you do. Here's how you respond, okay? So now, chapter 8, verse 1 now, the Lord spoke to Moses and says, take Aaron and your son. So now we're back to a dialogue about Moses, Aaron, and his four sons. So the change, we're about to see a change in the narrative, okay? So if you were to stop right now and kind of make an observation about chapters 1 through 7, what would you say? What are they about? Offerings, and which ones? Okay, the five that we saw, and you would break them down that way, okay? And then as we read chapter 8, you're going to realize, oh, something just shifted. There's a change in the narrative, okay? So if I were charting Leviticus, I would stop and make that observation and say, huh, it seems like something's happened after chapter 7 that's changing into chapter 8, okay? Now, chapter 8, we're going to kick this thing off, right? We have seen at the end of Exodus The tabernacle was filled. The presence of God is there. But what have we not had yet? We've had a whole book, or seven chapters of a book that are dealing with what? The law and sacrifice. Have we had sacrifice in the tabernacle yet? No. So, man, we got to pull the ripcord and kick this thing off. Chapter 8, here we go. So God is now going to say, let's do this, okay? Chapter 8, verse 1, Lord says to Moses, take your sons and his sons with them and the garments of the anointing oil of the bowl for the sin offering, the two rams and the basket of unleavened bread, and and assemble all the congregation of the doorway of the tent of meeting. So it's Moses telling Aaron, Aaron, grab you, and you have four sons, okay? Nadab, Abihu are the two oldest sons, and his younger two sons are Eleazar and Itamar, okay? The first two sons that are getting called up out of the dugout right now are the two oldest, Nadab and Abihu. So those are the guys that are playing, okay? They are the JV priests, okay? They are the helpers to Aaron. What role does Aaron have, by the way? He's the high priest. He's the grand poobah, okay? He's the guy, okay? Not Moses, but Aaron, okay? Because he's from, well, that's the role that God has for him, okay? So, bring all the stuff, come to the doorway of the tent of meeting, assemble the whole congregation, and we're going to watch this together, okay? Moses does what God commands, and in verse 6, pick up there.
And Moses brought Aaron and his sons and washed them with water, and he put the tunic on him, girded him with the sash, clothed him with the robe, and put the ephod on him, and he girded him with the intricately woven band of the ephod, and with it tied the ephod on him.
All right, so you're seeing here the garb that Moses is now adorning Aaron the high priest with. Okay, in Exodus chapter, I forget, at the end, okay, there's a whole chapter on what the high priest would wear, and it's all a picture of his intercession for Israel. There's a ornate hat and this tunic and purple and royalty and a breastplate that would have 12 stones on it that represented each one of the tribes of Israel as he was interceding before him. So the high priest would wear this. It was fancy. It was a big deal. It was like what you would go wear to prom, right? This is not your regular garb. It is a big deal, okay? So for the first time now, Moses is putting this on Aaron. What does he have to do first in verse 7? Verse 6. You got to take a bath, okay? Not just physical, but we're going to see Aaron's got to go through a process to cleanse himself before he can minister on behalf of the people, okay? 8, you see all the stuff that's added in 9 as well. Verse 10, Moses took the anointing oil and anointed the tabernacle and all that was in it, okay? So he anoints that. Verse 11, he sprinkled some of it on the altar 7 times, okay? On the basin, the utensils, all the pieces that are inside the tabernacle, Moses is anointing those. Put the anointing oil in verse 12 on Aaron's head to consecrate him. Verse 13, next Moses and Aaron's sons came near and clothed them with tunics, girded them with sashes around their bound caps on them. Not quite as cool as like what Aaron would have been wearing, but some priestly garb nonetheless. And then in verse 14, read that.
And he brought the bull for the sin offering, and Aaron and his sons laid hands on the head of the bull for the sin offering.
Okay. This is the, what was the sin offering again? We just read about it. Unintentional sins, okay? So before Moses and Aaron, or Aaron and his boys can go in and minister on behalf of the people, what do they have to do first? They have to offer a sacrifice for who? For themselves. And what kind of sacrifice is it? Yeah, sin offering, which means what? It's unintentional, right? So just to make sure we're good, right? And the Monopoly deck is like wiped clear and we have no bad debt, right? We're going to make sure that we're clean before God and we're going to put our hands on the head of the bull. We've seen that picture. We'll keep talking about it. But before they can minister, they have to get right with God. Okay, so they go first.
With the garments, did we pass that already?
We did, yeah. It was at the end of Exodus.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah. The Urim and the Thummim?
Yeah.
Those would have been, this is a terrible modern-day illustration. They're basically dice that you would roll, that the high priest would have, to determine the will of God. We have no idea what they look like, but the high priest would have carried them. And when they were making decisions, it was kind of like your magic eight ball. God, do you want me to date this girl? No, not a possibility. Dang it! Shake it, you know. You guys know what a magic eight ball is? You guys are too old. Thank you, Anna, for nodding. Some of us know what that is. That's the idea. So it was some type of thing that they would use to determine the will of God. The incense is different, and we'll get to that this morning as well. Okay, but they would have this super cool garb, and the Urim and Thummim had to be, I don't know, that would be cool. God, do you want me to do this? Oh, yeah, cool, right? Like, we all dream of that secretly. If God would just write us an email or write it in the sky and go, oh, okay, you want me to take Herndon today? Perfect, because there's traffic on Shaw. Yeah, anyway, so that's the idea, okay? So sin offering first for Aaron and his sons, again, ministered by Moses. Moses slaughtered it in verse 15, took the blood, and with it put his finger around it on the horns of the altar, purified the altar. He poured the rest of the blood in the base of the altar and consecrated it. What do you notice that Moses is having to do with the actual elements inside the tabernacle before they can be used? He slaughtered it, took the blood, and put it around the horns of the altar and purified the altar. Why would he have to do that? What's wrong with the altar? It was built by sinful people, right? And it needs to be purified, to be sanctified, to be made holy, set apart before it can be used for God's purposes.
How come if they're not allowed to touch dead things, they're making sacrifices and dealing with the blood?
That's the priest's job, okay? Because partly it's because of the picture of what the blood is as a means of atonement. It's to be used by the priest in that area. This was part of their religious system where God says, in this environment, this is where it's okay, and it does not make you unclean, okay? So it seems, we'll read that again here in a couple chapters, but yeah, it's an odd mix, okay? So verse 17, the bull and its hide and its flesh and its refuse shall be burned outside the camp. So part of it was burned here with the sin offering. Part of it you took outside the camp, like the intestines and the other stuff that weren't considered valuable or what have you, and you would leave those outside the camp, and you would burn them with fire in an area that was a clean area outside the camp, okay? Then in verse 18, he presented the ram of the burnt offering, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram, okay? This would have been probably for the people, so now that Aaron and his two sons that are participating are walking with God and they're good and their sins have been covered, now they're beginning to intercede for the people for the first time and offering a burnt offering for the people, okay? Verse 22, now there's a second ram, a random ordination, like to commemorate this actual like launching of the tabernacle. And watch what happens. They take the blood from it. Verse 23, watch what Moses does.
And Moses killed it. And also he took some of the blood and put it on the top of Aaron's right ear and on the thumb of his right hand. The big toe of his right foot.
All right. By the way, like, Will and Cass are carrying you as a group. Like, if they weren't here, nobody would read. You're all terrible, okay? Carrying you. Your backs have got to be hurting right now. This doesn't happen with every sacrifice. This is a ordination deal. This is like a first time, and you're not going to see it consistently. Moses takes the blood from the offering and puts it on Aaron's right ear, on his thumb, and on his toe, okay? What's the picture? Why would Moses do that? What's Aaron's job?
Essentially, like, carry out the sacrifice to atone.
Okay.
Intercede and atone.
To intercede for the people. So what does he have to be keenly aware of within Israel? Sins. Okay. So he has to know what the people are doing. He has to be able to also commune with God, right? I need to hear God. I need to serve the Lord with the presence of my, you know, my hands, and I need to seek God with all that I am. So it's his ears, his eyes. It's the idea that your whole body is being used to minister before God, and you need to remember that. You have a higher role, right? And that's kind of the idea. So hear the Lord, serve the Lord, and seek the Lord, something along those lines. But it would have been in the idea of, Aaron, everything that you're about needs to be in tune with God so that you can minister on behalf of God to the people, and you can make them right before this holy God and these people who are not holy, and to do that. Okay, so he does the same in verse 24 with the sons. Okay, the Nadab and Abihu takes the fat, and you kind of get moving through all of this, kind of more details of how this thing gets launched for the very first time. Okay, 31, Moses said, now skip ahead a little bit, to Aaron, boil the flesh at the doorway of the tent of meeting, eat it there together with the bread that is in the basket of the ordination offering, saying, Aaron and his son shall eat it. So one of these offerings, the peace offering, would have been offered now, and Aaron and his sons would have eaten a portion of that offering, right? That was the uniqueness of the peace offering, that not only the grain offering was offered in the offer, sorry, the priest got to eat part of the offering, but also the peace offering, which was a male of some sort, they got to eat a portion of that as well, okay? So not only did they get bread and grain from one offering, but they got meat from the other, okay? So again, how do the priests get to eat? By the sacrifice of the people, not just grain that we saw yesterday, but now with the peace offering as well. They now, for the very first time, get to eat a portion of that offering, okay? Now, we're getting ready to do this. We're inaugurating this. This is like a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the tabernacle, okay? We're getting everybody right with God, the priest included. And now in verse 33, these are the words spoken to Aaron and Nadab and Abihu as they're preparing to go through the ceremony themselves for the first time.
And you shall not go outside the entrance of the tent of meeting for 7 days, until the days of your ordination are completed, for it will take 7 days to ordain you.
Okay, so we've ordained these guys, right? I went through an ordination at a church when I finished seminary, and they launched me out, and I got in a circle with a bunch of dudes, all the elders, and they prayed for me. It took 30 minutes. It was great. Put on a tie, and then I went home. Okay, it was cool. These guys get ordained at the doorway of the tent of meeting as everybody's watching, and Moses says, stay inside for a week and do not come outside, okay? Verse 35, at the doorway of the tent of meeting, moreover, you shall remain day and night for 7 days and keep charge of the Lord that you may not die, for I have commanded. So if you leave here in the next 7 days, what happens? You're dead. Okay, do you think God is serious about setting these guys apart, making them holy, preparing them for the work that God has for them? Yeah, just a little bit, right? So you're in there for a week, get your mind right, get your heart right. We've cleansed you of your sin, but you're going to stay. Okay, so it's a big, big deal. So Aaron and his brothers, or his sons rather, are going through this process, and the entire nation is watching them go through this. This is a big deal, okay? Now, in chapter 9, we're going to continue along those lines, okay? They're going to get instructions for, be given instructions rather to the priest and what they're going to do. So chapter 9 is all about that. Pick up in verse 6 and now see what Moses is continuing to communicate to the people, or to the priest rather. Okay, so he's talking to Aaron specifically, and this is his role. Man, your job is that the glory of the Lord may appear to you. You're going to minister on his behalf, okay? Verse 8, Aaron came near to the altar, slaughtered the calf for the sin offering, which was for himself. So now at the end of this ordination process, they're now offering more sacrifices before they can minister to others again. Not just the ordination, but now the actual process of them getting right before God. Verse 15, Aaron presented the people's offering. He took the goat for the sin offering, which was for the people, and slaughtered it and offered it for sin. Okay, so he's right, the people are right, and now we are at the end of this ordination process. Aaron, Nadab, Abihu have been there now for 7 days. It's kicked off, and they're beginning to offer sacrifices. Okay, chapter 10, we're going to see ordination ceremonies over, and now we're going to actually offer the first sacrifices in the tabernacle outside of this ordination ceremony. Okay, so chapter 10, verse 1, let's pick up there. Okay, so let's stop real quick and talk about this, okay? Andres brought it up earlier. When you would offer the sacrifice on the altar, right? When you walked right into the temple, there was the altar in front of you. You would slay the animal. You would put the animal on top of the altar where you slayed it, and then you would burn it. And underneath were the ashes that were created by the fire. The priests would have fire pans. Think, I don't know, like a stick with a dustpan on the end of it, but metal, okay? And they would literally take from the ashes of the altar, they would take those burning ashes, they would bring those inside of the tent of meeting, inside kind of the second area, and they would add now The perfume mixture that we talked about last week in Exodus, little frankincense, little myrrh, little whatever, and you would create this aroma that would smell correctly in the tabernacle, and that's what was offered on the altar inside kind of that area, okay? So they were doing their job, okay? But it says they offered strange fire before the Lord, okay, which he had not commanded them. So we don't know exactly what this strange fire was, but what we do know was there was a very clear recipe that God wanted to be offered. Now, the end result of this is verse 2. This is shocking.
So fire went out of the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord.
Wow. So Nadab and Abihu, the two oldest sons of Aaron, are going through their priestly duties. They just went through this whole consecration ceremony. People are cheering and wigging out like, hey, the tabernacle works, and there's God, and they're the priests, and we're all good. First day on the job, it's like 8:45 in the morning. They've been there 15 minutes, and God just killed both of them for offering strange fire on the altar. What in the world did these guys do that would provoke God to that level of anger where he would say, you're done. This isn't a go offer a sin offering on your behalf or a burnt offering and get right and you can come back. You're done, and he kills them, okay? Rough day. Verse 3, keep reading.
And Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified. So Aaron held his peace. Then Moses.
Okay, stop there for a second. So Moses and Aaron are observing this situation, right? They're reeling from the fact that, Moses' two nephews just got killed. Aaron's two sons just got killed. And Moses' comment is, man, it's as God said, those who will come near me will treat me as holy, and therefore, and before me, all the people will be honored. So what's assumed in Moses' speech when he says, God's angry because why? They didn't treat him as holy. They didn't treat me as holy. What does that mean? What is God saying about the difference between him and the people? This is important for your understanding of the book of Leviticus. What is God trying to communicate in regards to approaching him? He ain't screwing around. He is holy, and you are not. And you can approach me by the means that I have created for you to approach me. I desire that, but you do not approach me haphazardly, recklessly, based on your own understanding of things and how you would like to do it, right? God says, no, I'm in charge. I made you. I have created the means for you to come to me. I am by nature set apart and holy and without sin, and you cannot be in my presence marred by sin. I have to take care of that. So these two guys did something in regards to dishonoring God's fundamental character, right? Who he is. Okay, it may have been chapter 10, verse 1. They offered strange fire. Okay, they offered something that was not right in this perfume mixture that God very clearly says in Exodus chapter 30. This is what you offer and how you offer it. Okay, so I said chocolate chip cookies and you gave me cinnamon raisin and those aren't going to work. Okay, I don't, maybe. Okay, now I say that kind of tongue in cheek. Okay, there's a great lesson to be learned from these guys. Okay, so let's keep rolling in verse 4 and following and let's watch this story and how it unfolds.
Then Moses called Michel and Elzaphan, the sons of Uzziel, the uncle of Aaron, and said to them, come near, carry your brethren from before the sanctuary out of the camp. So they went near and carried them by their tunics out of the camp, as Moses had said.
Okay, so they dragged these guys' dead body outside the camp. Moses says to Aaron, do not uncover your heads. Do not tear your clothes, for you, that you may not die, and that he may not become wrathful against the congregation. But your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. So what does he say to Aaron? What does that mean? Do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes. What was that a sign of?
Mourning.
Don't you dare mourn right now. You do not get to go to the funeral. You do not get to mourn the loss of your two sons. Why? What's Aaron's role? You're the priest. You've got a job to do. And this job at this moment is far more important than you taking a time off to go to the funeral. Okay? The nation will bewail the loss of these two young men. But right now, you've got a job to do. And if you don't do your job, Israel dies. Because you're the guy that's going to intercede on behalf of everybody, so you don't mourn. You do not even leave the doorway of the tent of meeting, verse 7, or you will die, for the Lord's anointing oil is on you. You're in the midst of offering sacrifices to God on behalf of 3 million people. You don't get to mourn right now, okay? Now, this seems really out of place, okay? Verse 8 and following. Read that, and maybe let's make some observations.
The Lord then spoke to Aaron, saying, do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And so to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean.
Okay. So what commandment now is issued? We haven't seen this before to Aaron and his sons.
Don't drink.
Why do you think God would stop at this moment and say, hey, by the way, don't drink when you're offering sacrifices to me? I think so. So they offered strange fire, probably not because they just like misread the ingredient list, but probably because they had had too much to drink. They had a celebration in this time of launching the tabernacle, and they walk in to do their job, and they're drunk. And as a result, God says, whoa, you do not treat me as unholy, right? Can you imagine like Brad getting into the pulpit hammered, or Shay teaching from up front drunk? Like the offense that would be, like how little you think of God just to walk into a pulpit to handle the word of God and to be intoxicated while you're teaching. I think that's what happened. And God said, oh no, you're dead. Like, wow. So he issues this command and says, no drinking while you're on the job. Okay. None of that. Okay. He doesn't tell them they can't drink, but when you're offering sacrifices, certainly not here. Okay. Now this gets crazier. Okay. Verse 12, Moses spoke to Aaron and the surviving sons, Eleazar and Itamar. Now this is the third and fourth born. Aaron only has four kids. Two are dead. Eleazar and Itamar, take the grain offering that is left over from the Lord's offering by fire and eat it, unleavened beside the altar, for it is most holy. So basically, these guys are in the dugout. They just got called off the bench, and they just replaced the two oldest sons, Nadab and Abihu, that are dead, and now they're the two JV priests. Okay? So, eat the grain offering that's been left. Moreover, he says, take the peace offering that was offered, and you're going to eat that as well. Okay, so you're going to finish this process that your two older brothers started. Okay, verse 16, Moses searched carefully for the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it had been burned up. So he was angry with Aaron's surviving sons, Eleazar and Itamar. So these guys get called off the bench, and they say, basically, finish the job that your brothers do. Offer these offerings and save the portion that you're supposed to eat for yourself that would have been an act of worship. Moses goes in to check on the status of said leftovers, and what happens? Whoops. They burned all of it. Didn't leave any for themselves to eat like they were supposed to. Now, if you're Aaron and you just watched your first two sons get killed by God in a miraculous way because of a oops, and then your next two sons get called off the bench, and they do the exact same thing in a different way, probably weren't intoxicated, but they certainly have an oops. They misused a sacrifice, didn't do what God had said. What are you nervous about as a dad at this point? Like, oh gosh, right? Am I going to leave here with four dead sons? This has gone from a great day to a really, really bad day, right? Now, Moses now in verse 17 asks, what the heck? Okay, read that.
Since its blood had not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary just as I commanded.
So what does he say? What's Moses saying to Aaron and his sons? You blew it. You screwed up. Why did you not do this? Okay? It's a very fair question. Now, Aaron's response is beautiful. Okay? And I want you guys to note this. This is not just a picture of the situation. This is a picture of the heart of God. And we don't get a ton of this, but what you see here is beautiful. Beautiful, and what God's heart truly is regarding laws and systems and sacrifices and obey and disobey. This is a picture of what really is at the heart of all this. Okay? Verse 19.
But Aaron spoke to Moses, "Behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord. When things like these happen to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord?" When Moses heard that, it seemed good in his sight.
Okay, and chapter ends. Okay, let's walk through that. Aaron now responds to Moses and says, "Hey, this very day, they, my two younger sons, Eleazar and Itamar, they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord, just like they were instructed to do. They did their job. When things like these happen to me," what is he speaking of now? What is Aaron saying? "My sons just died, okay? Emotionally, I'm not in a good spot. I am mourning. I am grieving. He's probably angry a little bit, right? But he finishes his job. He does what he needs to do as the man that's been put in this role. And he says, when things like this happen, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord?" Okay, interpret that for me. I'm in a bad place right now, Moses. I'm grieving, I'm hurting, and I'm not right with God right now. But I'm going to do my job because I know it's the right thing to do. It's important, and this is the role you have for me. But to eat this right now would have been it wasn't just food, by the way, for them to eat of that. What else was it a sign of for the priests? It was worship, right? So he says, I didn't worship. I didn't take communion in that moment. Why? My heart's not right with the Lord. So what's he saying? Would God prefer that I fake it and go through the motions when my heart is jacked and make a show and make sure I look externally religious? Or would he prefer that I don't follow the letter of the law and do everything that he's asked me to do because my heart's not right and be genuine and be honest and authentic? What is Moses' response? Seems right to me. That makes a ton of sense. Is there a punishment for the younger two sons and Aaron for not doing what they were supposed to do in terms of 100% box checking? No. And they say, that's not God's heart. So I think this story is put here for a reason. In the midst of laws, in the midst of obedience, in the midst of all these details and things that it looks like, man, is God like OCD and wanting me to earn his favor by doing all these, is that what the law is about? God says, no, that was never the intention of the law. The law is about you communing with me and for to keep you safe and all these other things that the law ultimately is going to do. But this isn't about religious box checking or external adornments where your heart is cold but your outsides look good. That's not what I'm after. I want someone ultimately that will walk with me. And Aaron made a really hard decision when his heart wasn't right and said, this is what's going to honor God. I'm not going to fake it. I'm going to live purposefully and authentically before the Lord, and I cannot worship right now because of what's happened to my sons, and God's honored in that. Isn't that a really cool picture in the book of Leviticus that's about the law and the expression of the law and how we connect with God, of what God's heart truly is? It's one of my favorite stories in the entire Old Testament. Okay, really cool picture.
It bears a striking resemblance to Acts 5 as well with Ananias and Sapphira.
Absolutely.
Because both of them are founded on, like, this is initiating the priesthood. This is initiating the initial church.
Yeah.
And there's this, like, big thing, if your heart's not right, mm-hmm. you die.
Yeah.
In both stories.
Yeah. And obviously, we don't see this every time somebody sins, but this is you get these snapshots of how God feels in these moments, and he doesn't always execute the same judgment, right? We're grateful that we don't have the Ananias and Sapphira every time that we are greedy or withhold from God or whatever. But you get a picture of, man, how God feels. So God says later on in, I think it's Malachi, "I wish there were one among you who would shut the gates of the temple. Like, you guys have been faking it for so long. I'm tired of it. And it would be better if you would lock the door to the temple and not offer sacrifices, then to continue to do this empty, heartless, rote worship worship that isn't worship, and yet on the outside it all looks fine, but your dead man's bones, your whitewashed tombs on the inside, right? That was the beef. And that's basically the beef that Jesus had with the Pharisees, right? You go through all these external steps to look good in front of people, thinking you're going to look good in front of God, when on the inside, you're dead, you're decrepit, you're morbid, right? There's no life in you. So don't fake it. So again, a beautiful picture. And it's just kind of the silence of how it ends where you go, wow, God's good. Moses is good. Aaron and the sons are good. They made the right call. And that had to be a pretty difficult decision to make, knowing when my sons didn't do what they were supposed to do and got killed, I didn't do what I was supposed to do and I got grace. It was the right thing in that moment, right? So
was Aaron like speaking for Eleazar and Ithamar? Because they were the ones that like didn't eat the offering.
Yeah, but Aaron's in charge and he didn't eat of it either. So none of them did. So yeah, so he's still in charge. He knows what's right to do. So he's taking the blame as well. Yeah, and there's atonement at times where the offering is the offerer. So yeah, absolutely. So they were their own offering. Absolutely. Yeah, Jake.
What would have been their kind of general view of the afterlife for them?
Abraham's bosom, a holding place for the righteous dead. So there would have been a sense of the afterlife and there was more to it that gets developed later, but yeah, some type of there's something after this where we our souls remain alive. There's a part of us that's still alive, and it's mentioned as Abraham's bosom in Genesis, I believe. Anyway, so they would have some sense of that. Okay, so cool chapter. All right, now let's keep moving. All right, now 11, you're gonna see another transition. Okay, so we just went from a bunch of sacrifices to now. 8 through 10 is like a story, right, that all kind of fits together. In 11, the Lord spoke again to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, take all the creatures from which you may eat, from the animals of the earth, whatever divides a hoof, whatever, and all these animals are about to get mentioned, okay? By the way, the words clean and unclean are going to be mentioned 100 times in the next five chapters, okay? 11 through 15, 100 times those words are going to be mentioned. So what do you think chapters 11 through 15 are about?
Squirrel.
Great answer. Almost. Okay? It's about being clean and unclean, right? What's clean? What's unclean? Now, when we use those words, what in the world does that mean? What does clean and unclean mean in context of Leviticus and worship and sacrificial stuff?
What's allowable?
What's allowable, for sure. Okay, part of it's holy and unholy. If I am clean as an individual, what do I have the ability to do? Go before God. I can worship because I'm clean. What else can I do? I can hang out with you guys. Okay, so I have right relationship with people and I have right relationship with God. Okay, if I'm unclean, what do I have to do? I've got to get clean, and I can't commune with y'all and I can't commune with him. I have to get clean. Now, does unclean always mean sin? No. Okay, there are times it does, when you do dumb and you become unclean because of a sin. There are also times, like the sin offering, where you're like, well, I had some unintentional sin in my life. I didn't know that I did, or I touched a carcass. Like, that's not sinful, but you did indeed become unclean. Or, man, I ate something that I wasn't supposed to eat and didn't know it. Now I'm unclean. I got to get clean. Or there's a gazillion things. There's actually a gazillion, I shouldn't say a gazillion. There are some good and noble and God-honoring things that make you unclean, okay? One of them would be intercourse between a husband and wife. That makes you unclean until the evening, okay? So there are things that make you unclean. A woman's menstrual cycle, according to Leviticus, makes her unclean, okay? It's a good thing. It's not sin. There's not an offering you have to make for it, but you're just unclean, okay? And we'll see kind of that process. Childbirth would make a woman unclean, okay, because of bodily discharges, and there's a whole chapter on that. I mean, it's, yeah, welcome to Leviticus, woo-hoo, right? You're not going to believe the stuff that's in here that I have to say publicly in the male and female crowd. Okay, it's nuts. Okay, now, so that's the overview of what we're talking about. Okay, verse 11. Okay, you see, now God's speaking to things that Israel can eat. Okay, what divides a hoof in verse 3? And choose the cud, and among the animals you may eat. Okay, so Here are the characteristics of the animals that can be on your menu. However, you're not to eat among those which chew the cud and dye the hoof and chew the cud. In verse 4, the camel, it does those things, but you can't eat it. Okay. Likewise, the saffron, or like the rock badger, it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof. All these crazy rules. Okay. The rabbit also, though it divides the cud or chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof. It's unclean. The pig is unclean, right? So God's giving a list of all these animals that they can eat, and he's making distinctions based on their foot pattern, how they eat food. You know, to chew the cud is the idea of like a cow and how they process food. A rabbit looks like it chews the cud, right? But it really doesn't. It just chews quickly or what have you. So all this stuff is given, okay? Chapter 11 is their entire diet. Look how long this chapter is. 47 verses on what their menu's supposed to be, right? Do you think God cares about what they eat? A little bit, okay? Now, why would God say no bacon? Or why would God limit what they can and can't eat? Why would God be so picky about this? What would be the higher reason, would you guess?
Self-control.
Partly, yeah, maybe. Yeah. Some of it was a distinction. You're going to live distinct and be different, right? Some of it was just health-wise. Hey, those nasty bottom-dwelling fish at the end, at the bottom of the ocean, don't eat those. Like, there's stuff that God says, uh-uh, not on the menu. Probably because they're dangerous or could be harmful to you. So God gives them dietary laws to keep them healthy, to keep them separated, right? Maybe some of it was self-control. Later on in the New Testament, right, we're going to see these things back on the menu, right? A sheet descends, and Peter's like, oh, bacon, yes, right? You guys read that. So it's not that they're evil or that they're bad. They're just things that God says, hey, this is what you're going to eat. And part of it was for Israel's health, okay? And you see, again, all those words. And all of chapter 11 is about food, okay? Clean and unclean. Eat this, fine. Eat that, makes you unclean. You're unclean, you get to go to the tabernacle. You get to hang out with Eleazar and Itamar. They're going to make you right. You're going to offer a sacrifice. Should be good, okay? Chapter 12. Lord spoke to Moses, verse 2, when a woman gives birth to a male child, then she shall be unclean for 7 days, as in the days of her menstruation, she shall be unclean. On the eighth day, his flesh shall be circumcised, with a circumcision on the eighth day. Then in verse 4, she shall remain in her blood of purification for 33 days. Okay, so a woman gives birth, okay, she's unclean for 7 days, plus an additional 33 days. Okay, so you have a male child, 40 days, you're considered unclean, okay? This is for sanitary reasons, for the health of Israel, that sort of thing, okay? Now, that's a male child. Verse 5.
But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for 2 weeks, as is customary impurity, and she shall continue in the blood of her purification 66 days.
So 2 weeks plus 66 days, 80 days if you have a girl. So if you have a male child, you're 40 days unclean. If you have a female child, you're 80 days unclean. Why is that? Because boys are better than girls. I have no idea. I'm teasing. No idea. Okay, that was just what, I have 3 daughters at home, so I can say that, right? No idea. For whatever reason, okay? And then verse 6, when the days of her purification are completed for a son or a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the doorway of the tent of meeting a one-year-old lamb for a burnt offering, a young pigeon, a turtle dove for a sin offering. So to become clean again, you would now offer to God. That's, by the way, what Mary was doing in Luke chapter 2 when she was going to the temple offering sacrifices. She was ending her ritual unpure or uncleanliness to become pure and right before God again. Yeah, Haley. Partially. There's some truth to that. In that society, obviously, women were, especially in the cultures around them, not deemed as valuable as males. So, partly.
I guess I'm just a little confused on, obviously, you can be unclean and not have it to be sinful at all.
Correct.
So, I don't understand why a sacrifice would then be required, especially like a sin offering, like why that would be required if there was no sin intact.
Yeah, I think it's just the idea of becoming right again. This is not a sin situation. Clearly, childbirth is great, but it does involve bodily discharge. So that's why. So any where is it? 15, yeah. All of chapter 15 is about bodily discharges, okay? 33 verses on bodily discharges that all make you unclean. Okay, we will read some, not all. it's too early, and there's too many females in the room. Yeah, so that's the idea. So sex makes you unclean between a man and a wife, right? Is that sin? Clearly not, right? But it makes you unclean. So not sin, but yet unclean. So there's, we have to have that distinction in our head of unclean is not the same as sin, and it's not a punishment for something you did. It just is a reality of that's how God's system, that's his economy, that's how he operates.
So I'm thinking it has to do with like this portion right here and kind of the comment she made from her commentary, but it was in the New Testament somewhere. Paul basically says like women will be saved through childbirth or something like that.
Timothy, I think.
Like,
I don't think so. I think that idea of saved, I think it's in Timothy, Paul talking about the role of women. It's not saved in the idea of salvation, but the sanctification and the noble role of a woman is in bearing children, raising children. That is a noble thing. So I don't think those are connected. I'm not sure, but yeah, it's an odd deal, right? So why a boy versus a girl? I think Haley's, that note is probably telling of the culture. Yeah. Anna, you got a thought? Yeah, moms are like, heck yeah, you take care of the kid, I'm out, right? That sounds like Club Med. Totally, totally. Some uncleanliness, i.e. chapter 15, leprosy, sorry, 14, 13, chapter about to read. If you had a certain ailments, you were kicked outside the camp for fear that you would have some type of communicable disease and you got booted. So I don't think so with childbirth. I think there was some... part of the healing process that gave women a break, but not necessarily they couldn't commune with anybody. So you're not like 80 days, you know, out in the wilderness or what have you. So,
yeah. So would the mother not be present for the circumcision of their sin?
No, I think they would be. I think they just weren't to go to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices and couldn't commune in a worship ceremony. They couldn't go to Passover if that happened then. Those types of things they could not participate in. Okay. Chapter 13 is all about leprosy. They use the word leprosy. It is a bigger picture category than modern day leprosy, or Hansen's disease is what we think of. Lepers that have the ailment where you're literally your extremities would like fall off and rot, your nose, the ears, fingers, toes. That's called Hansen's disease. This would be included in that, but a much broader category. So any type of oozy, pussy skin ailment, okay, would be included within the idea of leprosy, okay? And the idea is, if you have an issue, if you have some type of like, man, I got a blotch on my skin, I don't know what it is. Honey, do you know what it is? Nope, go to the priest. And the priest would look at it, he'd examine it and go, ooh, buddy, that's no bueno, okay? You're outside the camp, I'll come check on you in a few days. And literally, God had set this up, and all of chapter 13 is talking about this process of boils and scabs and itchy scabs and bleeding scabs and white stuff on your skin. It's a lovely chapter, but it's to protect the people from disease. So if you have a disease, do you get to live with all your other people in close quarters? By the way, man, you stuck 8 people in about 500 square feet. You think if I have a boil or some nasty oozing thing and I'm in that tight of quarters with my family that everybody else is going to get it? Absolutely. It's like pink eye, right? It's like, no. Remove yourself, don't touch your eye, outside of camp, and once it heals, you're back in. And the priest's job was to determine, yeah, that looks good, looks like it's healed, you're good, okay? It's not oozing and pussy anymore, come on back. And if it doesn't, then he would continue to leave them outside the camp until they had healed, okay? That's chapter 13, all right? 14 talks about the cleansing of leprosy, how one became unclean. It's very similar to chapter 16, which we're about to read, so we won't read it because I don't want to spoil chapter 16, okay? But it's, again, offerings and other stuff that they're going to do to make to make them clean again. It's some of the stuff that we've already read in 1 through 7, but there's some added nuances as to how a leper would re-enter the general public, if you will. Okay, so that's the idea. And again, you think God's serious? Chapter 14, all the way through 57, this is just how you get back into the camp. Okay, Again, dictated by the priest. He would determine if you're clean. You'd offer certain things, so on and so forth. Okay? Chapter 15 now. Okay, again, more start talking about clean and unclean things. This is about bodily discharges. 1 through 15 are discharges caused by disease. All the things that you could get in that realm. Okay? Chapter 16 through 18 is all about men and women, husband and wife, lying together, and the bodily discharges that are part of that process that would make you unclean. Okay, 19 through 24 is about a woman's menstruation, not making her unclean and what she would do. And again, there's no sacrifice offer, but she's unclean during that time. And then 25 through 33 are irregular discharges. Okay, I don't know what category you want to put those in, but like the and alsos. Okay. So that's the idea. I know you guys don't want any more information on that, so we'll just leave it there, okay? So 11 through 15, what are we talking about? Clean and unclean, okay? Are you able to worship? Are you not able to worship, okay? Now, I would assume had we read all these and you thought of all the things that could make you clean or unclean, do you think that at some point, like in your day or your week, that you're probably unclean, whether you meant to or not? That's kind of the idea. It's like, look, this is a big deal. And whether you ate something or touched somebody that touched something that shouldn't have touched that thing that touched that, right? You're unclean, right? If you accidentally put your hand on that counter that had a dead carcass on it earlier and that wasn't properly taken care of, now you're unclean. Like, really? I just put my hand on the counter. Yep, but you're unclean. Like, dang it, right? So you're convinced at this point that you're unclean and you need to get clean. So at some point on your journey in a normal day or week, you're going to become unclean, and you need a process to get you clean, i.e. right with God, that ability to now commune with him and commune with people again, okay? See also the sacrificial system, and then chapter 16 is the coup de grace, okay? Yeah, Jacob.
So, I'm sure there's a lot of these things that the current nation of Israel doesn't currently practice, like stoning people. Where do they get away with not doing some of these things?
Some of it's in that regard, just laws of the day that they can't do. Their conundrum is they don't have a temple. So they physically can't do these things. They can't offer a bull. They can't offer a sacrifice. They can't do any of this stuff. So what's replaced temple worship and sacrifice is keeping the law, because that's all they're able to do. So there's a heightened view amongst the ultra-Orthodox in Israel of keeping the law. Okay, so you'll see different, you can literally visually see in Israel, different stratospheres of society based on where they land on the spectrum of how they view the law. And the most ultra-Orthodox people have a certain garb that they wear, won't trim their beards, and they adhere to the Mosaic law, to the jot and tittle, to the best that they can, okay? So that's kind of what's gotten replaced today. So, yeah, Stephen. Yes.
And just live in that space, understanding that do it, but with the nation of Israel's issue, that they just really thought that they could do it, and they just kept, having their heart turned away.
Yes and no. Okay, so the first part of what you're saying is dead on. Okay, take that a step further. Going to become unclean, constantly offering these sacrifices, day in, day out, week after week, year after year, constantly. What are you hoping for as an Israelite? Couldn't we just have like one final, like really good sacrifice that could put this to end, not for like today, not tomorrow, but forever, right? So that, what is God doing in them? He's ingraining a hope of a Messiah that would solve this problem. What's the problem with their system? Well, your priest is unclean. Your animals are just animals. They don't remove sin. They simply cover sin. They atone sin. It's a kafar. It's not a, there's a picture there, but it's not permanent. The sin is still there, but God is giving you a get out of jail free card for a bit, but your sin's still present. So it's creating that need. So instead of them having a hope for a Messiah, they just said, you know what, screw it. We'll fake it on the outside, go through the actions, and let our hearts be miserable, and yet just kind of keep doing the religious stuff so that we look religious. And that's where it spun out of control, and that's where their hearts got hard and did all the externals, but their internals weren't right. So that's where they missed it with God, okay? So that's ultimately where they're at today. And yes, you talk about the ultra-Orthodox, the OCD stuff that they do, that's according to the law, you look at it and you go, that's not what God wants. That's not his heart, right? But that's their only way that they know to please God, because they're still waiting on a Messiah. They don't have a Messiah that solved that problem for them.
What's a kafar?
Covering. It's it's the root word of atone, to atone in Hebrew. Okay? Kafar, something like that. I'm probably saying it incredibly wrong with my fabulous Hebrew Texan accent. Okay? So, 16. Okay? Now, let's back up for just a second. Okay? We're going to see a change in the narrative again. Okay? Talking about Israel's feast and festival schedule. Okay? You got the spring festivals that we've already looked at. Passover, first fruits, unleavened bread, right? That was the, Moses was told, hey, you're going to do this every year. Those were all back to back. Those were the three that happened in the spring. March, April season, okay? Had to do with the harvest of wheat or barley, whatever season that they're in at that point. Those are the spring festivals, okay? Passover was their first of the year, kind of like our January 1st. It reset the calendar, okay? Now we're in the fall. We're September, October, and there's also three feasts that occur in this timeline, okay? And the one that stands on its own is Pentecost, okay? That's in between the fall and the spring. But these three feasts would have been Rosh Hashanah, okay, trumpets, Yom Kippur, okay, which is the one we're about to look at in verse 16, or chapter 16, and then booths, okay, which was a reminder of how God provided for Israel in the wilderness journey. So you would literally, everybody would go camp in the wilderness and say, this is how we did it for 40 years, and God took care of us, okay? Now, this holiday that we're about to look at here has the idea of the religious new year, the inside portion, okay? So what do we do on January 1st? Aside from celebrating and partying and resetting our calendar, what's the other aspect of our New Year's? Yeah, introspection and what?
Change.
Goals, resolution, change. That's what this day was, okay? And it wasn't just a day, it was 10 days, okay? Rosh Hashanah, the trumpets, the Feast of Trumpets, you would literally stop work, okay? And we'll see this in the text, for 10 days. And you would go introspective, okay? So dreamers loved it, achievers hated it, right? But you would think, what have I done this year? What's my year been like? Who did I sin against? Who do I need to get right with? And if you know any Jews during this season, you will see modern-day Jews currently reaching out to individuals. Is there anything I've done that offended you? Eric, did I rub you wrong? Did I say something at work that may have bugged you? Will, did you and I get off and that thing that I said? And they're trying to make relationships right coming into Chapter 16, Yom Kippur, okay? So God literally mandates that they stop and reflect for 10 days, okay? It's big, it's significant, it's not celebratory in that sense. It's very individualistic, and it's also a nationwide thing that they're going through this process, okay? So chapter 16, verse 1, with that in mind, let's talk through kind of this day. All right, so now we're getting instructions for the first time of this holiday, and Moses is telling Aaron, hey, you don't get to come and do this whenever. This is one time a year where you're going to enter inside the veil where the ark is, okay, the most inner portion of the tabernacle, and you're going to do some stuff in this day during this time. And if you enter this place any time other than Yom Kippur, what's the consequence? Death. And this is, by the way, right after the death of his two sons, Nadab and Abihu. So he's like, got it. Crystal clear, okay? Aaron shall enter the holy place with this: a bull for a sin offering, a ram for a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen tunic, and the linen undergarment shall be next to his skin, and he shall be girded with the linen sash and the attire of the linen turban. Now, what do you notice is repeated in that verse? What type of garb?
Linen.
This is not the same garb that we talked about earlier, okay? This is not the priestly ornamentation. This isn't the real fancy hat and the breastplate. This is a simple hat that's white linen, a white bathrobe, and a sash to tie it around you. Simple, white, clean, not ornate, okay? Why would God change the garb on this day? Why would that matter? Where would the focus normally be in a religious ceremony? On the priest. Why? Because he's got this sweet decked out gear on. Now, he's got a white linen bathrobe and a sash and a hat. Simple. Where's the focus going to be? God. And what's about to happen today. Okay? Goes through all the stuff that he's going to do. Okay? Now, in verse 5, okay, here's where it gets good. Okay, so he offers his first fruit sin offering for himself. So we've seen that before. Aaron's got to get right, offer his offering for unintentional sins, just in case. I'm good now, okay? He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting, okay? So we've got two goats, you see in verse 5, for sin offerings, okay? How many goats do we normally see for a sin offering or a bull or whatever? One. Aaron's bringing two. Okay? They're both for the same thing. They're both for the sin offering. Okay? He shall take them to the doorway of the tent of meeting. Verse 8. Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, probably with the Urim and Thummim, roll them, and decide this. One lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. Two goats, and they're each going to have a different role. One will be for the Lord, and one will be a scapegoat, an Azazel. Okay? Verse 9. Keep reading.
The goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement over it, that it may be sent away into the wilderness.
All right, so we see these two goats, and they're going to have a different role, okay? 12 and following, you see all the aspects that we've seen before, the fire pan, what they're to do with this. But these two goats are now becoming the focal point of this day because it's unique and it's different, okay? One time a year, they've been in reflection for 10 days. They've been processing their sin. The people have been thinking about it, and now they're here, and this is their lap around the Monopoly deck, okay? This is their get-out-of-jail-free card for another year. This is how God is going to allow Israel to exist with him for another year. This is kind of the nature of that sacrifice, okay? So, verse 14. He shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat. The mercy seat was what covered the ark inside the Holy of Holies. He puts the blood on the mercy seat, okay? He shall sprinkle the blood with his finger seven times, okay? Then he shall slaughter, verse 15, the goat for the sin offering, which is inside the veil, bring inside the veil, with its blood, what they did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat in front of the mercy seat. What's the picture here? He's taking the shed blood of an animal and putting it on top of the Ark of God, okay? What's under the Ark of God, by the way? What's within it?
The Ten Commandments,
which are, have they been kept? No. They're whole, but they've been broken, right? What's on top? Angels and? Starts with G, ends with odd. Yes, God, okay? So as God is looking down into the dwelling place of his people at the center of the camp, and he sees the broken law of the people. What is covering the broken law of the people? A blood sacrifice. So how does he see the people? As covered, as clean, as atoned for, because there's a blood covering the broken law. Okay? Pictures. Okay, you with me? So that's the first goat. Okay, inside the veil. This is the only time of year this happens, once a year. Okay? He shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the sons of Israel. So they have to re-atone for all the utensils again because humans have touched those for the last year, even in a right worship setting. Okay? Now, all that gets into detail there. Okay? Now, we have slaughtered one of the goats. We've got second goat. One was for the Lord, i.e., the goat that got slaughtered that we just read about. And then there's this second goat, the scapegoat, the Azazel, 21 begins the narrative of this goat.
And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall put them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who is in readiness. The goat shall bear all their iniquities on itself to a remote area, and he shall let the goat go free in the wilderness.
Okay, so let's talk about this whole picture now because we haven't gone into detail, okay? We have slaughtered a goat. We have atoned for the sins of the people. And yet now there's this second goat that Aaron literally stands over. He takes his hands. He puts them on the head of the goat. And what does the text say he does? He confesses the sins of all the people, verse 21, all their sins on this goat, right? Loads the goat with Israel's sins for the last year. How long do you think that process took, right? What's he saying? Oh, and then there's Mike. And Mike did this, and Mike said that. And now we're going to get to Bob. And now, I don't know. But he's confessing all the sins of 3 million people onto this goat. Everybody's around, right? They are watching this take place. They're seeing Aaron intercede on their behalf, laying their sins on this goat, okay? And what does the text say in regards to that sin? He shall lay them on the head of the goat, send it away into the wilderness, and the goat, in verse 22, shall bear on itself all their iniquities to a solitary land, and they shall release the goat into the wilderness. Okay? What's the picture? What is God trying to communicate with Israel with these two goats? The first goat would have symbolized what? Atonement. Sin is forgiven. Okay? However, what do you and I tend to wrestle with when we sin? And maybe it's habitual sins or repeated sins or sins that we know better than doing, but yet we struggle with them anyway. What do we continue to feel? Shame and guilt, right? We carry those. We burden ourselves up with them. We say that sacrifice isn't enough. And God says, oh, wait a second. What is God doing with this second goat? All the sins of the nation are put on this goat. They are transferred over through the hands of Aaron. And where do their sins go? They're gone. You see the picture. God is saying in this moment, not only have I forgiven your sin, I have removed your sin. It is gone. And history tells us that more than likely they took this goat and kicked it over a cliff, right? Because the last thing you want to see is said goat walking back into your camp the next day. You're like, oh God, it's the sin goat, right? It's a scapegoat. So, and they would even, history says in some texts that they would even take a Gentile, that a Hebrew wouldn't even take this goat because it had so much sin on it, it would make you unclean. They would find someone that would do it that didn't care about the religious system, and they would let them lead them out of the wilderness and kick the goat off the cliff or what have you, okay? But this is a picture for Israel, right? I have forgiven your sin, I've covered your sin, but I've also taken care of the guilt and the shame and everything else with your sin. It is gone. It is removed. So this people would see, God didn't just take care of the issue. He took care of everything regarding that issue. And in his presence, what is he left to see now? If the sin has been atoned for and the shame and the guilt of that are removed, what does God see in regard to your sin? Stop. Nothing. It's gone. It doesn't exist. It's not here. So this people had the audacity to believe that God could not only forgive their sin, but remove the consequences of their sin, remove the guilt of their sin as far as the east is from the west, right? And he did this every year with the people. Isn't that an amazing picture? Do you see what God is trying to get them to see? So they would have to do this repetitively. They would have to do it constantly. So what would their hope be one day? Wouldn't it be great if we had a sacrifice once for all that could not just cover our sins, but remove our sins, like the picture of this, and we wouldn't have to do it yearly because the system's broken, but we could do it once and for all, and we'd have a sacrifice that would do this forever. Remove me from my sin and the guilt of my sin and make me right before God forever. That's the picture.
Do we have an idea of how Aaron went about knowing the sins of all the people?
I think he lived with them. I think he knew.
I
say that tongue-in-cheek, Haley. I don't think he's giving a laundry list of all my sins, right?
Yeah.
And then Mike said this, then he flipped that guy off in traffic, and then or whatever. I think he's – I haven't done that today. But still early. I think he's just talking about, we covet God. We do – or whatever. So it's probably general, but they really did sense that that guy is atoning for me. My sins are being placed on that animal, and that animal's going to leave. But the people felt that and lived that and saw that and believed that, right? That's crazy. Isn't that nuts? I mean, that's a really sweet picture that God offers his people so that we can understand what forgiveness is, what true forgiveness is, and how God sees us when we have assimilated Christ into our lives. Our sins aren't just forgiven, they're gone. He doesn't see them because they have been paid for, and it is arrogant and offensive to God to carry the guilt and the shame of our sin when God says, I dealt with that. And for you to now re-harness yourself with that guilt and shame is offensive to the sacrifice that I offered for you, because you're saying it isn't enough. It's inadequate in what it's done for you, right? That's the picture. So probably my favorite chapter in the entire Old Testament, right? In everything that we've read thus far in Leviticus has been a stair step to get to this place so that people could see you need a sacrifice. You're unclean. You can't do it yourself. Don't screw around. I'll kill you. I'll kill the two sons of Aaron. I am so serious about my holiness and your lack thereof. And that same God can say, you can stand in my presence clean and right with me because of the atonement for sin that I have made possible on your account. Mind-boggling, right? Now, what is this supposed to do for you and I? What is this supposed to give us a picture of?
Jesus.
Yeah, this is a backdrop, right? It doesn't teach Christ, but there's something about understanding Jesus and maybe in light of this sacrifice that takes the picture of what he did for us from SD to HD. We go, this is what God was doing. This is what he's trying to show the people. This is why he took Israel through this entire process and then brought them to Christ to create the need, to help them understand they need a Savior. They are a sin-stained and unclean people because of accidental things, because of intentional things, but they need to be right before me, and I will one day make them right once and all for forever, which is why it was so offensive when the Jews basically thumbed their nose at God and said, we don't need you. Called Jesus, you know, you minister from Beelzebub, you're from the devil. That was the most offensive things that the people of God could do to God, because they should have gotten it and they didn't. And that's what was so tough. So God says, great, I will now offend you, and I'll go to Mike and Peggy and the Gentiles, and I will give them the gospel that was meant for you and the people ultimately, but I will offend you with a people who are not a people so that you will understand that there's a need for a Savior and so on. Okay?
Do you know if there's any significance to 26 and on? It says that the bull and the goat that were bled, they weren't burned as an offering. They were taken out of the camp.
Yeah.
And burned by some random guy.
Yeah, it's a random guy. I don't know those. I think it was probably akin to the offerings where they took pieces of it outside the camp and burned them. I don't know that the picture is any different than what we looked at, though, so I'd have to look into that. Okay. So gang, noodle on this. This is the stuff that needs to hit us not in the head but the heart, right? We need to process this and assimilate this as believers and what God has done for us on our behalf, okay? And I'm convinced if you don't understand Leviticus 16, you can't understand the full intricacies of the cross and what it meant, right? You can still obviously love Jesus and know it, but I think this just adds clarity to the significance of the sacrifice of Christ, because they lived this and they felt this and they breathed this, and it's meant for us, and that's why God kept it, so that we can begin to understand that and know it. Okay. Any thoughts on that as we kind of wrap up? Okay. Well,
I was just going to say, why don't we hear this on Sundays at church? Because I know a lot of people look at the Old Testament as not necessary when mm-hmm. it helps us see Jesus mm-hmm. clearly.
Yeah. You know what? Obviously, we don't teach this all the time. We have taught this numerous times here. So, and we are a church that believes that the Old Testament is the inspired word of God, and we are committed to continue to teach stuff like this. So you'll hear it here, for good or bad or worse. But yeah, we've gone through it a couple times. So, okay, that's why your Old Testament is so important, by the way, right? This is why I love teaching Old Testament. So it's fun because it adds clarity to who Jesus is. We're setting the backdrop of the stage so that when he comes on it, there's just more insight to who he is and what he's done. Okay, so, all right, gang, you guys have a great weekend. Be safe. Enjoy yourselves, and we will see you next Thursday.